You're listening to Split Reel, the Chicago Independent Radio Project show on popular culture and societal attitudes. I'm your host, Kevin Fulham, and I'll be examining how film, television, and other elements of mass media both shape and reflect how we think about the world. For more information or for archived shows, visit splitreelradio.net. Welcome to the inaugural edition of Split Reel for the Chicago Independent Radio Project. My name is Kevin Fulham, and I'm happy to be joined by Andrew Schopp, who is an assistant professor at Nassau Community College. Good morning, Andy.
Good morning.
And Matthew B. Hill, an assistant professor of English at Coppin State University. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning.
They're the co-editors of the recent book, The War on Terror and American Popular Culture, September 11 and Beyond, a collection of essays which examine how pop culture has reflected societal concerns about the American response to the events of 9/11. So, Andy, I'd like to begin by talking a little bit about the inspiration for the concept of the book. What were the flashpoints which signified to you that the war on terror was having a concrete impact on popular culture in a thematic sense?
The actual basis for the book, or what motivated us to begin to put a collection together, was that Matt and I were both participating on a panel in a conference where we presented the papers that became our respective chapters eventually. So in a very practical sense, there was just a lot of interest among the people who attended the panel. This was in 2006, and at the time we weren't sure whether there were other collections that were out there, but there was certainly seemed to be an interest among academics, at least, to sort of explore the ways in which pop culture was responding to 9/11 and the war on terror. And we sent out a call for papers, and we got a lot of really, I think, very interesting responses that ranged from, you know, television and film to music, etc. For me personally, I think a flashpoint, what really kind of drove home that our pop culture was responding, especially because immediately after 9/11, there tended to be this assumption that anything dealing with, or that might even be alluding to the attacks was, you know, being censored from pop culture, so that even there were reports of syndicated series like Friends having the Twin Towers sort of erased from any of the transitional images during the episodes because we didn't want to remember this. And so films being shelved because they were depicting terrorism or violence or something, films that had been made prior to the attacks that were due to be released. So there was initially a kind of sense of, you know, we're not going to show anything, we're not going to address it. For me, it was actually seeing the film V for Vendetta, which I saw because my students recommended it, and I teach composition and we look at pop culture. So I was starting to see, you know, sort of resonances of 9/11 showing up. But when I saw the film and I had read all these reviews that said it had nothing to do with 9/11, and I was kind of floored by that when I saw the film, then I went down into the subway to come home, and there were all of these reopened 9/11 stickers on the subways and on the walls. And somehow it just started to click that ideas about what's happening in our culture since 9/11 are manifesting. That's what led to my paper, which led to the conference. And as we say in the introduction, I think, you know, what we really begin to see probably 3 to 4 years after the attacks is pop culture not necessarily explicitly addressing the war on terror or 9/11 culture, but certainly you start to see evidence that our pop culture is trying to, in various ways, address it.
Well, I want to start by talking about Todd Shack's chapter in the book, where he points out similarities between the wars on drugs and terror. And they've both evolved these shadowy enemies with roots overseas. With the war on drugs, we've had the South American cartels. With the terror, we've had the Middle East. What are your thoughts on the government's manipulation of the media and Hollywood regarding these two fronts?
One of Todd Shack's big points in his chapter is that a lot of the new films coming out in the 2000s were kind of casting American policy in a skeptical light. And I agree that I think over the course of the last few years, the same kind of trend has been happening with war on terror films. The war on drugs is still a good war, but it seems to be the specifics of that war, like in traffic, internal contradictions of that war, and kind of the tactics of the drug war are definitely up for negotiation. What I see in a lot of the war on terror movies is that the same kind of dynamic is getting deployed, like the specifics and the effects and the negative effects of the war on terror on those who fight it and on the culture itself are being displayed. I'm thinking of films in the Valley of Ella, Stop Loss, to a lesser extent, The Hurt Locker, Body of Lies, kind of some of those Iraq war films. But that kind of underlying patriotism, that kind of underlying us versus them mentality, that this is a war that is somehow worthy of being fought, I think that's still, that fundamental paradigm is still very much present and not up for discussion.
Well, two things struck me with the question immediately. When you talk about the government's manipulation of the media in Hollywood, I do think it's interesting. One of the things that we point out in the introduction as well is the number of scholars who note, I think Susan Faludi for sure mentions this, the way in which the Bush administration almost immediately sought Hollywood out after the attacks to figure out sort of the best ways to spin this. And so the kind of integral relationship, despite the different politics, you know, there's a tendency to assume that Hollywood products lean more towards the liberal end, but there's this kind of integral relationship between administrations and the media. But the other thing that struck me when you mentioned this was when John Kerry was running for the presidency, he published this essay in New York Times Magazine about his plan for dealing with the war on terror. And I thought about this actually also when I first read Todd Shack's essay, because part of what he talked about in there was that essentially what we would need to do to address the war on terror is to model it after the way the government had gone about dealing with the war on drugs, which was to deal with it in all of its complexities. And I think one of the things that a film like Traffic for Drugs and Syriana for the War on Terror shows is that there's these incredible complex network of power interests, economic interests, personal interests that are all working together. But part of what Kerry was getting at in the essay was that what we would really have to do to address the war on terror in the same way as addressing the war on drugs is far too complicated to be able to put it into a soundbite, which is what the American public wants. So, you know, in the 80s, we had Just Say No to Drugs as though that's a way of actually dealing with drug addiction or with the drug problem. It becomes this moniker that's out there that, you know, it's this nice little soundbite, but it completely effaces the complexities of what the war on drugs was about. And so I think the films that we see, my take at least on the films post 9/11 is that some of the more interesting ones are trying to deal with complexities, but I think that on both sides, you either have, on the one hand, the United 93s and World Trade Center, which are nothing, to my mind, less than kind of memorials to 9/11 and don't want to interrogate or question any of the complexities of what happened. Or you end up with some political films that, as many reviewers claim, are just preachy. They're so overtly political in sort of dealing with that. To my mind, The Hurt Locker is really interesting because I still don't know what the politics really are of that film, but it also doesn't discuss the politics, you know, and it also seems really interesting to me because it's framed with that quote from, which I believe is from the book, that, you know, either war is a drug or war is an addiction. And it just seems to underscore even more that there are these comparisons between the war on terror and the war on drugs. I mean, I thought Todd's essay was really sort of profound in making that connection.
I believe that the epigraph was from Chris Hedges' book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning.
Okay.
And Chris Hedges was a war correspondent, and he kind of, a lot of that book is about talking about his own experience as a correspondent, kind of getting that adrenaline rush of being
right
on the front line. And I think in terms of the politics of The Hurt Locker, I think that very self-consciously segments off kind of the geopolitics
right
of the war in Iraq. I mean, it's that the main character, Sergeant James, is kind of almost mythologically apolitical. You know, there's no animus toward almost anybody in that film, even the enemies. He's cold and he's calculating. He gets off on the actual act of doing what he does. It's kind of that isolated, personal, transcendent experience of war, you know, that
right
the film definitely avoids any kind of overt political statement. And I think that's part of the power of it.
Exactly, that's part of why I found it more interesting, was exactly because of that.
I think also, you know, if you look back through history, political films in general, they just don't fare very well. Of course, Hurt Locker didn't fare well at the box office either, even though obviously winning Best Picture now, I'm sure people are going to give it a great deal of attention now on DVD. It's interesting. I mean, we have not seen any sort of films, though, championing our presence in Iraq, have we? Depicting that the Saddam Hussein Iraq as being a terrible Iraq, you know, here's this despot. It's just interesting that even in the wake of all the patriotism, the rah-rah pro-America sentiment after 9/11, we have seen pro-military films like Black Hawk Down, Do you think the public would have responded to a pro-American invasion movie? You know, the way we had lots of movies about, you know, the heroes of World War II, for instance.
Yeah, I'm not sure that we're there mythologically yet. I mean, I think that you talk about pro-military movie. I mean, I find it kind of hard to kind of differentiate the pro-military movie from the pro-militaristic movie, for lack of a better term. Let me just take a quick example. Like, what I thought was a phenomenal piece of work was David Simon's Generation Kill, which I think was definitely not in the same kind of jingoistic way as something like John Wayne's The Green Berets was a kind of pro-Vietnam film. It's, I don't know if you've seen that film, but it was brutal in its own sense of propaganda. But Generation Kill, I mean, it was a perfect example of what Anthony Swaffer talks about in Jarhead, which is a fabulous memoir of the first Gulf War. He talks about how all of these war movies, no matter what political stance they're taking, any of these combat films, I think Swaffer would probably talk about The Hurt Locker, Generation Kill, that he would argue that's a pro-war film, in that when young men see these films, it kind of celebrates their own power. And especially young men kind of in the military see these films, even if it's an anti-war film like All Quiet on the Western Front, you know, that they see in that film the reflection of their own warrior prowess.
The celebration of war without any sort of political ideology attached.
I think that it's not a celebration of an overt political ideology. I think it's that undercurrent of militarism that a lot of these films inadvertently celebrate. You know, if someone were to make a hero of the film is a Blackwater contractor, I'm not sure that the public would go for something like that.
You're listening to Split Reel, and my name is Kevin Fulham, and I'm happy to be joined today by Andy Schopp, who's an assistant professor at Nassau Community College, and Matt Hill, an assistant professor of English at Coppin State University. And they're the co-editors of the recent book, The War on Terror and American Popular Culture, September 11 and Beyond, a collection of essays which examine how pop culture has reflected societal concerns about the American response to 9/11. One of you mentioned Oliver Stone just a little while back. Oliver Stone brought us Platoon, brought us Born on the 4th of July, certainly films depicting the horror and the aftermath of Vietnam. But he also produced the more clean-cut, the heroic-themed World Trade Center, which depicts police and firefighters in the wake of the 9/11 attacks dealing with the catastrophe. How do you kind of reconcile the two?
I don't know if I would look at it as a film like World Trade Center as being the way it is because of Oliver Stone. To my mind, something like W is vintage Oliver Stone, and it came out afterwards. I mean, it has the same kind of, you know, critiques and the same, you know, about at the time what was a sitting president. I think the issue is, I'm trying to think of, I know that and Jeffrey Melnick has a book called 9/11 Culture, and he cites a scholar whose name I'm forgetting. But who's argued that, I mean, to my mind, the issue is it was at a time, it was so close after what happened, and it was specifically and directly about the event that what the scholar argues is that essentially it has to be a memorial. And so as a result, I mean, Judith Butler, a number of folks have argued that it's incredibly difficult. It was incredibly difficult in those first years to in any way interrogate and to question, and to have what would be sort of typical for Oliver Stone, the kind of satire, the probing questions, the scathing indictments, you just couldn't do it. And I think, and going back to what Matt was just saying, I think in a lot of ways, the more indirect things are represented, the more you kind of get the questioning and the answers, but at the same time, the more you can also get sometimes the reinforcement. But Matt, I don't know what your take on Stone would be.
Well, I've been doing some research into some sociologists, a guy named Niels Melzer and someone named Jeffrey Alexander, called a cultural trauma. And I've been looking at how cultural products respond to these kind of extreme cultural hurts, you know, these mm-hmm. big events like 9/11, like Pearl Harbor. And I think that what a lot of these theorists talk about is kind of like in the wake of a cultural trauma. I mean, and I think that the phrase in the wake of 9/11 is almost so common in parlance now. I mean, it's,
right.
When you talk about 9/11, you always talk in the wake of 9/11. It's kind of fundamental cultural rupture. And a lot of cultural trauma theorists talk about like events like 9/11 as kind of shocking people into this kind of a need for stability and a need for sustenance and a need for kind of to do cultural repair work. You know, that there's something fundamentally wrong that that we have to remedy. And I think that we saw these icons, I think, of American critical thinking after 9/11, and Stone is in the forefront of my mind. I mean, Stone is a guy who gleefully slaughters the sacred cows of American history in nearly every film he's done. I mean, he's usually extremely smart and extremely critical and blunt about criticizing American values, American policy, and offering alternatives. But, you know, you think about how kind of the critical senses of a lot of American voices were dulled just after this attack. That, I mean, you had Dan Rather, I think Sean Zwagerman in the book brings this up.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember this exchange from Letterman that Dan Rather, you know, who's a personal hero of mine, he's one of the greatest investigative reporters we have, I think, uncritically asserting on David Letterman's show that the attacks are motivated by terrorists essentially hating our freedom because we have everything, because we win everything. You couldn't, since you're so close to it, you could not interrogate it. And I think the World Trade Center and United 93 are very good examples
mm-hmm.
of that. And I think Susan Fluke does bring this up in her book, The Terror Dream. But I always go back to what T.S. Eliot says. He says in The Dry Cell Ages, we had the experience but missed the meaning. And I think works that just reflect the events, reflect the attacks, they don't examine them as to what were the motivations. Where are we in history that this happened?
Where we do see an interrogation of what was happening is it's often in places that you, on first glance, you wouldn't think, you know, that mm-hmm. this particular film or this. I mean, I think the Muntean and Payne's essay about the distinction between sort of pre-9/11 zombie films and post-9/11 zombie films is really sort of on point here, that initially you just think, oh, these are great horror films and there's been some changes in the zombies. But to notice, you know, they make the argument that, you know, George Romero's are Cold War. They're slow lumbering. They take their time. Whereas post-9/11, the threat is suddenly immediate. It can come from anywhere. It's fast. It's rapid. It's unseen. So that, you know, initially you might not think of 28 Days Later as being a 9/11 film. But when you start looking at the idea that if we can't address it in these films that are more explicitly and directly about the actual events, that we have to start looking at how do we see these ideas of any kind of interrogation about 9/11 manifesting.
Mm-hmm. And even more so, even that sense of interrogation of any cultural trauma is much more successful, I think, when it's indirect. And I'm thinking of The Dark Knight, which is mm-hmm. most definitely a terror film. The Joker represents that same kind of, you know, sudden, unpredictable anxiety that the post-9/11 zombies represent. And I think that the political positioning of Batman and the other authorities in Gotham City is a little more complicated, but we see the same kind of indirect interrogation. And in a lot of ways, Nolan's film is a lot smarter about how terror affects our lives and what choices we make in response to terror.
Right now, I want to jump to Matt's chapter on Tom Clancy and 24. It's been often repeated, I guess, through news media, how Jack Bauer is a fictional character. It's amazing how he has just risen to such a level of prominence regarding political debate, especially with regards to the issues of torture and waterboarding. And, you know, this came up specifically during the Republican presidential debates a couple of years ago. I think it was Tom Tancredo from Colorado who mentioned how, you know, when chips are on the line, you know, you want Jack Bauer being the person who out there interrogating criminals. But this idea, and I think you mentioned it in the chapter, Matt, that this rogue law enforcement officer, I think you mentioned, you know, the Charles Bronson character from Death Wish. We certainly had, you know, the old Western heroes, the Clint Eastwood Dirty Harry films, the law enforcement figures that go outside the lines in order to bring in the criminal. So we've had this long history throughout American pop culture. What makes Jack Bauer and 24, and even if you want to talk about the Tom Clancy heroes as well, too, what makes them different, or how have they been specially impacted by the War on Terror?
When 24 came out, I was just as enthralled as a lot of other viewers. You know, I've never seen anything kind of that fast-paced and that kind of compelling when it first came out, just in terms of its form. But as the character develops, I came to see him as more and more and more disturbing. He's really kind of just a confluence of very dangerous and anti-democratic kind of American warrior mythologies. And the fact that this character can be deployed, even rhetorically, in any debate on actual intelligence gathering practices is disturbing. But I think that this goes back to that idea of this cultural trauma. I think that when cultures go into this damage control mode, they retreat to some kind of these essential fantasies, like these rogue law enforcement figures. And Bauer's the perfect example of that. But I think on another way, Susan Faludi and Richard Slotkin call this guy kind of these frontiersman heroes. They're these figures who live on the border of the civilized and savage. They're not completely within our culture. They don't have good domestic lives, but they're also not these brutal killers. They kind of live on the border. And that's a very, very old archetype in American culture. They exist kind of on the borderline of civilization, and they protect the innocent by any means necessary. You know, they protect the culture, and they're kind of the paternalistic daddy figures who can protect us when all other things fail. And he exists outside the system of laws, you know, and this is completely by design. A couple scholars, Robert Jewett and John Shelton Lawrence, have written a couple books on this idea, and they call it the American monomyth. The perfect, unselfish hero comes into a helpless community and saves it from an outside evil. And Jack Bauer does this every single day. The flip side of this is the democratic process, collective action, cooperation, small-R republicanism, can't deal with kind of the paternal responsibilities to which these heroes get called. You'll notice that, you know, Jack Bauer is always shown in opposition of all these kind of corrupt politicians. I think two of the main villains in the first season of 24 were the White House staffers, and even later on, the president himself becomes implicated in some kind of terrorist plot. This fundamental mythology that when we are hurt as a culture, we look for these powerful figures, and they're decisive, and they're paternal, and they're pure, and consummately professional in terms of Jack Bauer. It's only because of that he's an attractive character. What makes Bauer different than all these other guys like Dirty Harry and Popeye Doyle might be a good example, Charles Bronson, is that even when in the past a lot of these little threats to civilization were kind of isolated, when the bad guys, you know, the drug gang was defeated, a lot of these threats in these older fictions are kind of isolated, you know, that when they're defeated, and the paternalistic hero can go away, and then the society can go on living. With 24, when you import Jack Bauer into this war on terror, which is an amorphous conflict, who knows when the war on terror is going to end? It's always this kind of generalized bad guy outside of our borders, outside of our consciousness, that is always there. When George Bush was kind of announcing the war on terror, he pretty much said, this is going to be an open-ended conflict. Our victories are going to be quiet. Our defeats are going to be quiet. We're not going to even know when we win. I think putting this kind of frontier hero in this kind of open-ended conflict, I mean, I think it really invites a lot of kind of dangerous anti-democratic impulses into play. And I think you see that in that kind of rhetorical use of Bauer as a political tool.
Could you make the same argument, though, with the vigilante cops? You know, there's always going to be crime around. There are always going to be gangs and, you know, whether it's the mafia or whoever to deal with. And that there's always going to be a role for instance, that kind of Dirty Harry sort of figure.
Yeah, well, I think that when you pair this idea of 9/11 into it, the kind of baseline fear I think that we exist in terms of, you know, getting mugged on the street or having our car stolen, I don't necessarily think that necessitates kind of a Bronson-esque or Jack Bauer-type intervention. But when you add the cultural anxiety of this massive, sudden death coming from the symbols of our own freedom, which are airplanes, when you add that sense of deep and abiding fear into that dynamic, I think it's a slightly different experience.
I just thought of as James Bond. You know, all the James Bond films have all revolved around some sort of villain that has this master plan to destroy the Earth, or, for instance, Goldfinger, you know, wrecking the U.S.'s gold reserves. There have been a million masterminds throughout the years, and they've actually been influenced a great deal in terms of global politics. Over the last 10 years, I have not actually followed the Bond franchise that much.
Isn't that sad that I don't recall them? I don't recall much at all except for the action sequences.
Exactly. But I guess, now, could you draw comparisons between Jack Bauer and James Bond sort of character?
Oh, definitely. The things that make James Bond compelling, I mean, and this makes all those movies and Fleming's novels, you know, I think that the actual Fleming version in the novels of James Bond is a little more kind of brutal and a little more kind of hard-nosed than the filmic representations of him. But Bond kind of evokes a lot of the same kinds of characterizations as Bauer does. I mean, he might not be an American frontier hero, but he's definitely living on the border of civilization and savagery. I mean, he has his license to kill that places him outside of the normal sense of morality. Literally, he's granted a license to kill. Likewise, he's always shown with his resistance to domesticity and resistance to kind of being in a family, aside from maybe with Q and M. You know, his family are his workmates. I don't see him as the narratives that in which he appears don't seem to kind of fetishize the torture.
The Daniel Craig version is much more brutal than the Pierce Brosnan, and certainly than the earlier ones as well. I mean, at least from what I recall from Casino Royale, it was a much sort of darker vision than what we'd seen.
It is interesting, I think, though, that when we watch any of those old Bond films, we don't think about Bond going outside the law and assassinating people as being necessarily a bad thing. I mean, we don't view him in the same way that we view a Jack Bauer. Certainly, he has not been politicized at all compared to a guy like Jack Bauer. Is that primarily just because Jack Bauer is an American figure versus this British figure that's been around for decades and decades? There seems to be just a much different slant with the show of 24 that makes it resonate a great deal with the post-9/11 climate in a way that James Bond never has, even though he's always dealt with villains and acts of super terrorism and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I definitely think that you hit the nail on the head. The different ingredient is the Americanness and 9/11, that Jack is not kind of this super refined, hyper-sophisticated character vanquishing the Earth's enemies in the Queen's English. I mean, the idea of Bauer is that, you know, he's on American soil, and he's fighting the same war that we are fighting now. And I'm not going to say realistic. The whole ticking time bomb scenario, that's the big argument that lots of people make when they're talking about pro-torture arguments. Well, would you torture someone who had a canoe location of a nuclear weapon in New York City, and it was set to go off in the next hour? Many, many people say, of course. And Jack Bauer sees ticking time bombs, 8 or 10 times a season over the course of a single day. I think that the abstraction and kind of over-the-topness of James Bond, these conflicts are fantastic. You know, they're outside of our real world. You have someone like Goldfinger doing kind of these great and horrible things, but Bauer is really working in L.A. and he's really working in New York, dealing with what I think the perception is a more possible reality.
I just have one more question about 24 and Jack Bauer, and that's the issue of timing, because 24 debuted, I believe it was November 2001, just a couple of months after the 9/11 attacks, and obviously I'm guessing the first season was scripted out before the attacks even occurred, but would you have expected the slant of 24 to take in a different turn in the absence of 9/11?
Oh, definitely. I kind of imagined that 24 would have been kind of more akin to those James Bond films without 9/11. I think that the actual timing of the attacks, I mean, they probably had at least, 6 or 8 episodes filmed prior to the attacks. I know that a lot of those network shows film in advance. I couldn't see that a show like 24, I mean, it would have been kind of a lighter thriller, kind of like a James Bond.
Or Born Identity kind of film, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. That's probably a better analogy.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and you're listening to Split Reel, and I'm happy to be joined today by Andy Schaap, who is an assistant professor at Nassau Community College, and also Matt Hill, who is an assistant professor of English at Coppin State University, and they're the co-editors of the recent book, The War on Terror and American Popular Culture, September 11 and Beyond, which is a collection of essays which examine how pop culture has reflected societal concerns about the American response to the events of 9/11. So I want to get to Andy's chapter on interrogating the manipulation of fear. So Andy, you highlight 3 particular films, Good Night and Good Luck, V for Vendetta, and also Batman Begins, as a trio of films that directly deal with the concerns of post-9/11 reactions to, I guess, government authority, fear in terms of surveillance issues, for instance. Why don't you talk a little bit about that chapter?
Sure. I mean, essentially, the chapter's looking specifically was kind of motivated by the fact that all 3 of the films and a whole series of texts that came out, I begin talking about Joe Dante's The Homecoming, which was a part of the Showtime Masters of Horror series, which is about a series of soldiers that are killed in the Iraq War who come back and basically want America to stop fighting. And I look at sort of briefly a range of films that are dealing with how fear specifically gets manipulated in the media. So the discussion of Good Night and Good Luck is fairly brief, but one of the things I think is crucial is that most of the works, and we've sort of mentioned this before, that that are, I think, interesting and effective in how they deal with the after effects of 9/11 and the war on terror, have a tendency to displace the subject in various ways. So it may be that, in terms of genre, it displaces it into something like a superhero film that, you know, Batman Begins. I mean, I don't think most people would think of it necessarily as a 9/11 film, or even The Dark Knight, although I agree 100% with Matt that it is absolutely about terrorism. So I was looking at films that, and in the case of Good Night and Good Luck, it's, you know, I mean, George Clooney made, I mean, in interviews, he made it very, very clear that he made the film in part to, even though it's taking place during the McCarthy era and dealing with the way that the news media had to sort of fight to be able, you know, against those who would want to use fear to curtail what the news media was saying, that it was very much a film about how we might be allowing fear to allow us to go along with stuff like the Patriot Act, etc. So I sort of set up in the chapter that film as being in some ways the most explicit film about fear. But then I look at Batman Begins and V for Vendetta as films that are also sort of, I mean, in Batman Begins, the issue of fear is pretty central. I mean, there's the whole, the Scarecrow who uses a, you know, his drug that catapults sort of individuals into their own worst nightmares. And the entire plot centers around trying to use that drug to sort of get Gotham itself to sort of be exposed to it and therefore kind of come crumbling down because people will be indulging in all of their fears. So I kind of read it as a metaphor for the manipulation of fear.
While reading the essay, it struck me that many of the themes involved in, for instance, the Batman Begins film, you have the tearing down of a society of corrupt Gotham City, menial laborers serving as the agents of destruction for the enemy, and the attack on the financial center, the trains being driven into the financial center at the conclusion of the film. They mirrored those of the novel and film Fight Club, which came out before 9/11, maybe about a year or two earlier, where you have Project Mayhem, which consists primarily of these blue-collar employees. They enact a plot to destroy the nation's credit card companies and catapult America back to this sort of agrarian economy. And what are your thoughts on the similarities between the two films, especially because Fight Club predated 9/11?
Yeah, it's actually very interesting to me that you raised that comparison. For a couple of reasons. One is that I'm currently on sabbatical working on a book that is looking, sort of taking some of the ideas from that chapter and looking more broadly at fear in American culture. And I'm specifically looking at how that manifests in film. And I'm focusing on a set of films that come right before 9/11 and then a series of films after 9/11. And one of the chapters includes Fight Club, American Beauty, American Psycho. And it's looking at sort of fears about anxieties, cultural anxieties about masculinity and about the idea that men who have sort of bought into the American model of what males are supposed to do with their lives and ideas of success and specifically success in the business world, sort of rejecting that and responding to that. And I'm kind of comparing it with a series of films that come after 9/11 in which you have, I'm looking specifically at like the Judd Apatow comedies, in which you have these 20, 30, and 40-year-old men who are really boys and who are not in any way even holding serious jobs yet. And I'm trying to suggest in some ways that what we see, going back to what Matt was talking about with respect to this notion of trauma, is that there's almost a kind of depiction of paralysis after 9/11. In something like Fight Club, at least in the film version of Fight Club, there's the sense that while the men may be experiencing a kind of existential loss or ontological loss in some way, there's still a sense that they feel like they can do something. And what they're doing, sure, gets looked as domestic terror. And it's hard to imagine that the ending of Fight Club, given the ending of the film Fight Club, that the film would have been potentially released afterwards because, you know, bringing down the buildings and the idea that it was sort of a version of a domestic terror act. But it's also worth noting that in the novel ends with the protagonist in a mental institution. So there's sort of differences there. But what I think is interesting, to my mind at least, is that comparing something like Fight Club with some of the works that come later, one of the things that I think you see is the effects of that kind of rupture and trauma that 9/11 wrought. First off, you have these films that are now, for the most part, comedies that are dealing with male anxieties. But at the same time, there's not as much of a sense of being able to actually do anything about the scenario. What I think is interesting is that fairly recently, you have something like Observe and Report, in which you have again, a figure who wants to be associated with a certain amount of authority, a figure who's a security guard who wants to be a policeman, and his method of resolving that conflict eventually turns to violence. And Jeffrey Melnick talks about the idea in 9/11 culture that we're starting to see signs of 9/11 fatigue, and he suggests on the one hand there's the fatigue in the sense that we're just getting tired of the subject sort of collectively, but there's also another sign of the fatigue is that there's perhaps some healing. And one example he gives is the opening credits of Mad Men, in which you have the animated figure who's dropping down the skyscrapers, and he argues that, you know, a couple years earlier, before the series debuted, he couldn't imagine having an image that would so closely resemble the falling man, which is one of the iconic images of 9/11. So the fact that this could be presented without any kind of controversy suggests we've sort of moved forward. And part of what I think I'm starting to see is that I think a film like Fight Club could be released now without there being too much problem, because I think we're starting to get to move past that trauma to some extent. 9/11, in a way, galvanized a very, very fraught country. And we have to remember that, you know, it was less than a year beforehand that we had this election that was contested in the courts and that was so much a signifier of a disrupted nation and of a split nation. And, you know, despite the trauma and the tragedy, it brought everybody together, for better or for worse. And I think we're starting to see, and it's being reflected in the pop culture, we're starting to see more sort of tensions with that. At the same time, I think, to get back to the issue of Batman Begins, you know, again, Batman Begins is, there are a tremendous number of parallels between those films, but Batman Begins, on the surface at least, does not seem to be directly addressing conflict with America in the same way that I think Fight Club could be arguably seen to be doing so. So that may be, you know, again, to my mind, one of the things that allows Batman Begins to sort of address these issues is the fact that it's seemingly so not about it, if that makes sense.
Just one more note. One thing that also came to mind when you're talking about in Batman Begins, Batman being trained by his enemy, essentially. Mm-hmm. School of the Americas, you know, I was thinking of Manuel Noriega and all the so-called freedom fighters that we trained mm-hmm. in America that went down to Latin America and then became foes of the United States policy. So very interesting.
Absolutely. But even more specifically, the recent Aaron Sorkin film, Charlie Wilson's War, talks mm-hmm. about the same exact dynamics of all the machinations that American politicians use to fund these freedom fighters, or as they define freedom fighters, and the resistance to the Afghan resistance to the Soviets. At the very end of that film, there's a great scene between Philip Seymour Hoffman and Tom Hanks, where Philip Seymour Hoffman, who plays the CIA agent, who's a really bright guy, he's like, okay, now we funded these guys, and we've trained them, we've made them really great fighters. Now we got to give them some hope.
Right.
And that kind of, you know, setting that little epilogue to that film explains a lot of that same kind of, yes, we're deeply involved here, but we're only doing part. We're only doing part of the process of social change.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and I'm joined today by Andy Schopp, who's an assistant professor at Nassau Community College, and also Matt Hill, who's an assistant professor of English at Coppin State University. And they're the co-editors of the recent book, The War on Terror and American Popular Culture, September 11 and Beyond. And we've been discussing a collection of essays in the book which examine how pop culture has reflected societal concerns about the American response to 9/11. And just have a few moments left. I just want to talk a little bit about pop culture going forward in terms of the new strain of anti-government movements in the wake of the new Obama White House administration, certainly with something like the Tea Party activists. It's fascinating that the roles seem to be reversed as you see this resurgence of populist sentiment against the government, but in a conservative sense, although it's dealing primarily with domestic policy as opposed to any kind of foreign policy. And this sort of thing is not likely to be reflected by the attitudes of Hollywood scriptwriters. But how do you see this playing out going forward in terms of the kinds of films and television shows that we'll see?
It's hard for me to talk about like these populist movements, you know, because I think even just as an observer of the media, it's kind of hard to get a bead on the actual influence or impact of the movements or the Tea Party movements and kind of the media coverage of them.
Would you see a different response in terms of American, or different reaction to American foreign policy and pop culture now that the Bush administration is out of office? I guess it's probably a better question.
Oh, definitely. Yes. I mean, I think that without that, the climate of kind of absolutism, say what you want about George W. Bush, that the administration was nothing if not consistent in its policies. You know, there were myriad problems with those policies, in my view, but there was kind of that sense of unflinching, you know, this is the course we're on, this is what we're doing, and the kind of adverse effect on discourse that that had in terms of, you know, kind of being productive in terms of criticizing it, you know, or actually having hope that, that it would change. So I think that, that, I mean, it was that kind of absolutism of the Bush White House was kind of an easy target. So we saw a lot more films and TV shows start to question kind of this, the war in Iraq, the wars in Afghanistan. I think that with a new administration that, that seems a little more open to dialogue, I think that the criticisms, I think, will be kind of less strident of Obama, at least until people get a chance to really evaluate the policies.
I go back also to what I said a few minutes ago, which is I think what we're starting to also see in the culture at large, not necessarily yet in the pop culture, but I think what we're starting to see in the culture at large is that that sense of unity that for whether it was actual or merely response to the trauma of 9/11 that was there in the years afterwards is dissipating. The war is still going on, but the focus of the Tea Party movements and what's going on is now on what's happening here, not on some threat from outside. And because of that, I think that that's why we're starting to see. I don't think we're as I think we're going back very much to where we were sort of right before 9/11 happened, where things were really, really tense and the country was very divided. I think it's inevitable we'll start to see some evidence of that in pop culture. It's just a question of sort of how. One of the things I've been working on recently is looking at a whole series of television series, Lost and Dexter and Weeds, and all of these works that that sort of depict this sense of being sort of feeling kind of culturally lost, not sure where to go, not sure how to understand things like friend, enemy, self, other, criminal, not criminal. And what you know, we sort of see from about 2004 on is a whole series of these works that are really wrestling with the issues that I think 9/11 raised. And I think that's eventually going to start passing, and we're going to start seeing, you know, works in the next 5 to 6 years, whether it's films, television series, et cetera, that are probably wrestling with the effects of what's happening in our country because of the economic situation right now. We're in the lag period. It's almost too soon, I think, to say how pop culture is, has responded to what's going on currently. But what strikes me as incredibly significant is that I just feel like American culture is more akin to what it was like prior in terms of its internal domestic tensions. I think we're going to see this, you know, as you say, the some effects of the anti-government movements and a lot of these questions that are out there, but I think it's too early to tell exactly how we're going to see them manifest.
Yeah, and in terms of concerns, as far as they always do these political polls during presidential elections and congressional elections, you know, how important is the economy, foreign policy, Iraq? And you look at issues like global warming, for instance, there was a huge deal of attention placed on this a few years ago, especially with the Al Gore documentary and Inconvenient Truth. And then also with the Iraq War, you know, those issues have fallen far, far down the list now in terms of public consciousness. So that's also something it's fascinating to see. You know, hey, we still have the war going on. We still have troops fighting in Afghanistan. But right now, those aren't pressing concerns for the American public.
Well, I'd also be interested in some studies about the, again, what we talked about a while ago, the impact of technology. Because even if you think that, you know, 99, 2000, the internet was out there, but the way that today with you know, Twitter and all the various sort of instant ways to communicate, the way that information and misinformation keeps getting sort of presented, because it just seems, I'm constantly having my mom sending me the stuff that she gets, you know, about the healthcare bill or about this policy or about that policy. And it's like, this stuff is presented and it's sent around the internet and it's presented as being authentic information. And it's like, some of the stuff is you'd swear that we were living under, you know, the England of V for Vendetta, given the stuff that's supposedly happening. this kind of information being able to be disseminated, the question becomes, how much are people actually, believing stuff that gets presented that is completely fabricated? I mean, and do we have any way of knowing that? And so I'm wondering about how the kind of effects of the technological revolution that we're experiencing is also impacting how we're thinking as a culture and how we're viewing the culture.
So, mm-hmm. Obviously, with the birther movement and kind of all the various, myths about that recent healthcare bill, I mean, these narratives are getting proliferated that I think that people are kind of, the crisis in kind of identity and stability and a different kind of time. And I would argue that the economic collapse of, 2008 was akin to a cultural trauma like 9/11. Obviously,
absolutely,
not any nearly on that scale, but that kind of rupture in mm-hmm. culture that, when people saw their life savings, evaporate, when, huge investment banks are falling by the wayside. I think that same kind of need for stability, need for some kind of truth, need for something that is stable. I think, some of these narratives, completely fabricated as they are, gives people something to hang on to.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and you've been listening to Split Real for the Chicago Independent Radio Project. And I've been joined today by Andy Schopp, who is an assistant professor at Nassau Community College. Also, Matt Hill, who is an assistant professor of English at Coppin State University. And they're the co-editors of the recent book, The War on Terror and American Popular Culture, September 11 and Beyond, a collection of essays which examine how pop culture has reflected societal concerns about the American response to the events of 9/11. Matt and Andy, thank you so much for joining me today. I appreciate your time.
You're welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
For Andrew Schopp and Matthew B. Hill, I'm Kevin Fulham, and you've been listening to Split Real for the Chicago Independent Radio Project. And for more information or to access archived shows, visit splitrealradio.net.